Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And tonight we got some great stuff for you. Some big news.
A lot of news out there, Leo.
Lots of news. And I don't even know where to begin. I had thought of doing this one. There's so much stuff that this is a hell of a news day. But this one bothered me when I read it. And I thought I'd get it out of the way tonight. But
McCain begins attack on military and vets.
Yeah. This is the same John McCain who fought to stop the search for American POWs when our
intelligence offices reported live sightings from reliable sources. We learned that hundreds were alive while McCain was blocking efforts for the recovery. With McCain's position as Qatar, North Vietnam executed surviving POWs, particularly the 200 held by them in Laos. This was brought out in the tapes of conversations between Secretary Henry Kissinger and President Nixon that were uncovered in the Nixon Library in the 1990s. I interviewed the head POW recovery officer in Thailand, Colonel Jim Hankey, a longtime friend. I interviewed Colonel Ted Guy, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam hero who demanded McCain's arrest. I have interviewed so many over the years, and yet today Congress turns to him to support broken promises and more broken lives. McCain's peers, McCain's commanding officer, tell a story quite different from the one we hear on the campaign trail. What was held back about McCain, what is held back about his father, Admiral McCain, amounts to among the greatest scandals in the American military history. Aiding the enemy in Vietnam, allowing destruction of the USS Liberty and most of her crew by his father, the Congress and veterans organizations, the VFW and American Legion, worship this guy.
I know, and it just totally blows me away.
He's the creep of the worst kind.
He always has been, you know, and yet, you know, they think he's something marvelous, you know, and I don't know, just a great. Great PR crap. I mean, he's got this thing's coming up. It's from Poor Richard's blog. Okay. So there's something there, I'll tell you that.
Let's try to get an X that out and try it again.
Okay. Had some problems with this one earlier. Good. They could have pulled this down because of this article. This might be a problem.
Because everybody wants to think John McCain's a good guy.
Yeah, the minute they,
but
you know,
he's just a creep.
And it's a Blogspot, which is a problem, which is a Google, and Google, yeah, that's the problem. I think he's off the. I think he's been taken down. What a shame. All right. Well, enough of that. If you can find it, if it's still there, it's Poor Richard's blogspot.com, and I will guarantee you McCain's people took this down.
Let's just see, maybe it'll come up.
Attack this site.
We're hoping that it comes up. We'll just try one more time. We've tried and see.
I guarantee. And there's another problem with Blogspots.
You
can't get more than 100. Yeah, they took it down.
Yeah. Too bad.
Unbelievable.
How about this one? Just one single drop.
I was going to save that for later.
Oh, okay.
It's a health. It's on the Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's critical because it's a critical one. But I wanted to go to, there's one other here that I wanted to read. Then I want to go to the others that I have. Actually, I've got that on the other site. I want to read that one tonight, too. There's a number of health issues, topics that we have. I wanted to save till about 8:30. Okay.
let's just keep going.
This one I wanted to mention, too.
Anti-corporate rallies intensify in EU.
Right.
Hundreds of anti-corporation protesters have camped out in public places across major cities in Europe for a third consecutive day to rally against the inequalities caused by the Eurozone crises. Demonstrators, inspired by Americans' Occupy Wall Street movement, have set up tents in Frankfurt, Amsterdam, Madrid, as well as London, was reported. In Frankfurt, protesters have established a makeshift village in front of the European Central Bank, while Dutch demonstrators have erected outside the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. Let's see if we can get the rest of this. It's worldwide.
Yeah.
And this is from Press TV.
And
let's see.
Yeah. The Occupy Wall Street movement began on September 17th in the financial district of New York City in protest of a number of issues, including the wars in the Middle East, U.S. financial crisis, and high bonuses for Wall Street executives. On Saturday, demonstrations erupted in 951 cities in 82 countries in Europe, North America, Latin America, Asia, and Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And protesters have adopted the motto, "We are the 99%. They use a slogan to call attention to the fact that they are treated different than the 1% of Americans that are in possession of most of the nation's wealth. Another major protest is planned October 29th, ahead of the G20 summits in Paris. That's great. They're going to have one in Paris,
mm-hmm.
which is good. Excuse me a second. Running low on gas here for some reason tonight. Okay, that's about it for now. Thank you very much. Right. This one here, for those of you who are interested in the Occupy Wall Street, this is an interesting one, too. Turns out that...
This is from Alternate?
Yeah. It turns out that, I'll have you read it, but Occupy Wall Street, 992 arrested at price of tag of more than $3.4 million.
As the Occupy Wall Street protests enter their second month, and a new mini-society blossoms in Liberty Plaza in Lower Manhattan, the energized movement continues to tax the city's budget and display an increasing willingness to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience. According to statistics provided by Alternet, provided to Alternet by the New York City Police Department, police have made 992 arrests as a result of the Occupy Wall Street protests. The NYPD further tells Alternet that the demonstrations thus far have cost the city some $3.4 million in overtime for police officers. To put these numbers in perspective, 1,806 arrests resulted from the four-day Republican National Convention in New York City in 2004. The total security cost, according to a report by ABC News, was $80 million, which included overtime for NYPD officers. While the federal government picked up the lion's share of the cost, the mayor's office reported the city ended up paying about $8 million of the tab. Following the 2004 convention, more than 90% of the 2004 convention, that's what I said, more than 90% of the Republican National Committee arrest cases were dismissed or ended with non-guilty verdicts, resulting in a raft of litigation against the city. To date, according to a report earlier this year by Thomson Reuters, 152 plaintiffs have settled, withdrawn, or dismissed their suits, and the city has spent $1.8 million on settlements. According to the New York City Law Department, cases are still pending for an additional 474 plaintiffs, as many as 1,400 individuals. Each still stand to receive thousands or tens of thousands of dollars in damages as a result of a class action lawsuit. The city is already facing litigation as a result of the Occupy Wall Street protests. A class action lawsuit stemming from an arrest on the Brooklyn Bridge more than 2 weeks ago seeks unspecified damages.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's so they're major losers there. Major losers.
So they shouldn't worry too much about what they're spending to police occupy Wall Street when they spent all that money on the Republican National Committee.
Yeah.
Maybe they shouldn't be employing the police to attack protesters.
Maybe not. Of course, they were just given $4.6 million by the by the excuse me, by the J.P. Morgan.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Hang on a second. And pop-ups kill me. I don't know why they kill me. Why they continue to happen.
Just expand that so we can see it.
Yeah.
This is from Mother Jones.
Yeah, I'm trying to...
Huckabee to anti-union crowd, deflate car tires. Huckabee to anti-union crowd, deflate car tires and mislead voters. Former GOP presidential candidate Mike Huckabee, isn't he a minister or something?
No, yeah, he's a minister.
Has some advice for people who support
former
the
governor and,
for people
and
who
presidential candidate.
Yeah, for people who support the anti-union law passed in Ohio that faces a statewide repeal vote on November 8th. Find out who's voting to repeal the bill and block them from a ballot box. The one-time Arkansas governor suggested deflating tires and giving these voters the wrong election date. That's up to you, how you creatively get the job done, Huckabee quipped. What a jerk. Huckabee's remarks came during an appearance on Friday in Mason, Ohio, before a crowd of 350 people, according to Mason Buzz, a local blog that first reported the remarks. On November 8th, Ohioans will vote on Issue 2, a much-contested ballot referendum on whether to repeal Governor John Kasich's controversial anti-union legislation known as SB 5 that curbed collective bargaining rights for his state's public sector unions. Recent polls have shown that a majority of Ohioans support repealing Kasich's bill. Enter Huckabee. He has been stumping for voting yes on Issue 2, that is to uphold Kasich's anti-union bill, urging members of the audience to do the same, and to pray in support of the measure. As part of his plea, Huckabee told the Mason crowd, don't vote alone, vote with someone, family, friends, relatives, people you work with. Make a list. Make a list of 10 family members, 10 friends, 10 neighbors, 10 folks you work with or worked with in the past. Call them and ask them, are you going to vote on the issue? Are you going to vote for it? If they say no, well, you just make sure that they don't go to vote. Let the air out of their tires on election day. Tell them the election has moved to a different date. Local media have suggested Huckabee's voter suppression suggestions were offered as a joke. But they have an audio of that. Below is the audio of Huckabee's remarks. You be the judge. Hmm. You can play it if you want. Let's see what he says. Because he doesn't say much, huh?
For $2, and you raise your price to $4, and somebody else is selling them for $2, guess what? If the hamburger at $2 is as good as the hamburger at $4, nobody's going to buy a $4 hamburger, unless they're crazy. And most people aren't that crazy. So what they do, they go to the guy who's buying it for $2. If Ohio raises its cost of doing business significantly, it can be done in 4 or 5 days rather than in 90.
No speeding. This
issue two is simply giving everyone the opportunity to say we share this together.
I don't want to take forever to find it. Huckabee's advice came at the end of a bitter stretch in the SB5 fight early in the week, and a group backing the law was caught manipulating an ad supporting SB's fives of repeal and making the spot to say the opposite. In the original ad paid for by the union allied We Are Ohio group, an elderly woman named Marlene Quinn credits firefighters with saving the life of her great-granddaughter during a house fire, and says that voting to repeal Gus's anti-union bill will help firefighters do their job. But in the recut version, the pro-SB5 group Building a Better Ohio,
whose staff includes Kasich's former chief of staff, selectively edited the first ad's footage to make it appear as if Quinn supports SB5. We Are Ohio and other repeal supporters immediately condemned the disingenuous ad, and at least 30 TV stations pulled it from the airwaves. Quinn called the recruit the recut ad dishonest and downright deceitful and said she felt violated. However, Building a Better Ohio has stood behind the ad, and Governor Kasich said what they're doing is fine.
These guys have got no morals, and they've got no.
Melissa Frazakis, a spokeswoman for We Are Ohio, says Huckabee's comments were really shocking and a clear example that SB 5 supporters are willing to go to extremes to silence Ohioans who oppose SB 5. Given that the fight over SB 5 has been in the front line in the national clash over union rights, what happens on November 8th will hardly be a joke.
And it's like, you know, I mean, what is wrong with Republicans? I mean, what is wrong with these people?
I don't know.
They are morally...
he's a pastor. Huckabee, what a jerk.
Moral cripples. I mean, they're just like, you know, sick mothers.
Morally compromised, that's for sure.
Yeah, compromised. They're crippled. This is something interesting, too. it came up. This is from Top of the Town, Cannabis News. However, there are advocates for cannabis. But it says, one drug arrest every 19 seconds in the U.S. A new FBI report released on Monday shows that there is a drug arrest every 19 seconds in the United States. That's right, 3 people a minute, 180 people an hour, 4,320 people a day. A group of police and judges who have been campaigning to legalize and regulate drugs pointed to the figure showing more than 1.6 million drug arrests in 2010 as evidence that the war on drugs, really a war on U.S. citizens, is a failure that can never be won. And since the declaration of the war on drugs 40 years ago, we've arrested tens of millions of people in an effort to reduce drug use. This is a retired Baltimore narcotics cop who now leads the group Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And the fact that cops had to spend time arresting another 1.6 million of their fellow citizens last year shows that it simply hasn't worked. In the current economy, we simply cannot afford to keep arresting 3 people every minute in the failed war on drugs, Franklin said. If we legalize the taxed drugs, we could not only create new revenue in addition to the money we'd save from ending the cruel policy of arresting users, but we'd make society safer by bankrupting the cartels and groups who control the current illegal marketplace. Today's FBI report, which can be assessed by clicking on this site, shows that 81.9% of all drug arrests in 2010 were for possession only, and 45.8% of all drug arrests were for possession of marijuana.
Uh-huh.
Imagine that. A separate Department of Justice report released last month shows the Mexican drug cartels are currently operating in more than 1,000 cities in the United States, whereas 2 years ago they were in just 230 U.S. cities.
Wow.
Yeah. Meanwhile, a new U.S. Department of Health and Human Services report released earlier this month shows that nearly 1 in 10 Americans admit to regularly using illegal drugs. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. So it's just an absurdity that. Anyway. So getting back to basics, I wanted to let's go to this was an interesting article. Excuse me. Regarding Occupy DC emails show. Mainstream media, Dylan Radigan, working with the protesters to craft their message. Okay, I thought it was interesting because I think it's important that I wanted to play Radigan's rant. Okay, and I don't know if it's in here. Yeah, it is.
Okay.
I think it is. Yeah, here it is. This is Radigan's rant. So it was great.
Should we?
I wanted you to hear this.
Let's read this part first.
But
and
it's
then.
A brief article, but and then we'll play his...
Big Journalism has learned that the Occupy Washington, D.C. movement is working with well-known media members to craft its demands and messaging while these media members report on the movement. Someone has made the emails from the Occupy Wall Street email distro public and searchable. The names in the list are Whoops. Just you keep reading and I'll try to fix this. I don't know what happened.
Probably unplugged.
Yep, it did.
Okay. All right. I forgot where we were.
The names and lists are veritable.
Who's who in the media?
Yeah.
Journalist 2.0 includes well-known, that's the group here, that's the blog, includes well-known names such as MSNBC's Dylan Radigan, Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi, who both are actively participating in movements from other listeners such as Bill Moyers and Glenn Greenwald, plus well-known radicals like Noam Chomsky, remain unclear. The list also includes a number of radical organizers such as Kevin Zeese, which we've had on our show before.
Mm-hmm.
In these emails, we see MSNBC's Radigan hawking his book in the footnotes, instructing occupiers on how properly to present their demands and messages while simultaneously appearing on television reporting objectively on the story
when he's not taking part
in the protest himself as content. And I wanted to this was really a great rant, and it went viral on the internet. So here we go. This is Dylan Radigan telling
listeners,
not the listeners, but ranting at these guys on this panel. There we go.
People are coming from all over and all walks of life to send a message to Wall Street.
Capitalism, as it is operating, is just not working for many, many people.
They want to preempt legal protests because that could send an even larger message if there's even a minor disruption to the market.
That the voice of a growing class of Americans, educated, underemployed, and wondering what the government is going to do to realign the interests of the financial world with the Main Street economy. And this week, many of them have set up on Wall Street to protest what they see as a misalignment of interests between the financial community and the economy. Their chant all day, all week, Occupy Wall Street. It has been a largely peaceful demonstration with few arrests, and those have been for such reportedly outrageous crimes as writing in sidewalk chalk on the street, so it's hardly a violent crowd. How do we, however, forget the crowd for a second, how do we get the change that everybody, corporate executives, industrial executives, citizens, Wall Street executives, by the way, to align the interests of the financial community and the imperative for banking and investment services in a capital market that serves innovation in this country with investment in the American people? And joining us once again, former CEO and president of Verizon Wireless, a man who had to deal with the responsibilities of developing business while accessing the capital markets and putting this whole thing together, Denny Striegel, author of Managers, Can You Hear Me Now? He is our specialist today. And Denny, we always try to save our most controversial, and we want to make you as uncomfortable as we possibly can. That's really our goal.
That's successful.
As a good host. So at the end of the day, there is a sense that the interests of the financial, the investment world, are not aligned with the interests of the American economy. I agree with that. I believe that there's not capital requirements in that system enough that the people involved with it have the discipline to actually manage their risk in a way that works. What is the appropriate thing to do with the frustration? In other words, I can yell and scream on TV all day. It doesn't mean anything, right? You can go to the internet and you shoot your mouth off. You can come up with an idea, we should do this, we should do that. Your idea could be wrong, it could have unintended consequences. There's all these issues with ideas and mechanics that they're not in a broader scope with the principles and goals. If the goal and the principles have aligned interest between the financial community and Wall Street and the American economy, where would you begin?
Okay, so first, let me comment. What a wonderful country, right? Free speech, the right to assemble. You can protest anything. My question, I would flip it, is what are we really protesting here? We have a free enterprise system in this country. That is the financial underpinning of what we're all about. That is how we create wealth.
Can
it's
I answer that question
jobs.
Before you?
Sure.
I think there's a little speculative on my part, but I don't think it's that much. there is a sense that the free market, the market for innovation, the market for experimentation, the market for opportunity, has been rigged by virtue of the relationship between our government and money. And because financial interests are able to exert influence over rulemaking, not just on Wall Street, in healthcare, in energy, with the unions, with education, with whatever it is, that the merits and the principles of the marketplace that you celebrate and that I celebrate is in fact not intact because of the unholy alliance between money and politics.
I think it's unfair. And by the way, sure, are there contributions that are made to politicians, and does it give people access to offices? Perhaps that's true with some politicians. But the fact of the matter is, that doesn't destroy the underpinning of our capitalistic system.
That it does if there's no capital requirements. It does if the swaps market, which is where they fund everything, has no capital requirements. If I can actually sell insurance and not post any collateral, as AIG did, and collect that money from the government without any risk, that is not a free market.
Oh, so I'm with
right?
you. The government shouldn't be handing out money
right.
to
All
begin
right.
with.
I'm going to get in trouble if I don't get these people in, but it's nice to be talking to you. Go ahead, guys. Well, Jimmy or Karen, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm going to respectfully disagree. And I'm going to be
Are you
very
suggesting
polite
that I didn't respectfully disagree?
No. I'm just, you weren't here one time and I was a little bit disrespectfully disagreeing. Anyway, but I mean, if you just look at, I mean, you have more people living in poverty than ever before. You have more people unemployed than ever before. And yet corporations hoarding cash, people at the top making record amounts of money, the people, the loss of wealth, the disparities in this country getting bigger and bigger as 401ks tank, 401ks that are managed by some of these very companies. I just don't see how we can say the system is working when we are seeing that kind of disparity growing in this country, so that people up here are doing fine, but so many people down here are not. That is not a capitalist society that's working.
So I've been listening all day, and what I hear is that there's wealth at the top and there's less at the bottom, right? And there is a growing disparity. Let me ask you a question, a very basic question. I don't understand it. Isn't our democracy about the ability to create wealth? And by the way, I've seen figures used any which way. Here's the fact of the matter. Corporations today pay 39.2% federal income tax on average. It is the second highest in developed countries around the world. Individuals who are wealthy, I don't mean $200,000 families, I mean over $1 million family incomes, they pay 24.6% of the taxes, federal tax only. When you add to that what they pay to the state, what they pay to the local governments, 50 cents on every dollar goes to taxes.
But the issue
it's
is
those people.
But there's a couple of things that come up when you say that. They pay 50% of the money, 50% of the taxes, but control 80% of the money. So if I control 80% of the resources, shouldn't I be responsible for 80% of the costs? Or how is it that I should be able to control 80 to 90% of the resources, but only incur 40 to 50% of the costs? One. Two, you say America has the right to create wealth. Yes. My goodness, yes. Through creating value. Oh, my God. Help me, right? But there is a sinister distinction between getting money through extraction, selling insurance that you cannot pay the claims on, and keeping the insurance money, as our insurance companies have done in this country, in the financial community, with the swaps market. Selling or creating assets that do not create value but in fact extract that value using the tax code, trade, and banking. And the line between the honorable pursuit and the magical American pursuit of value creation and getting rich playing games that has blurred to the point where people all of a sudden are like, well, I'm just against rich people then, or I'm just against poor people, as opposed to the being for or against those who create value. And I think that is where this debate breaks down.
Okay. You are always going to have a bad apple, right?
But we're not in a bad apple. We have a system of bad apples right now.
That's not true.
That
is not at all true.
The swap market is a black market.
Wait a minute. What are we trying to do? Create class warfare here? I've been here all day. We don't have class warfare.
I just want to insert something here. The theory that we're creating class warfare when you have people that are sitting there holding mortgages that are worth nothing, I don't think that that's class warfare. I think that's a financial product that's not worth crap. And I think that our government let our banking industry sell mortgages to people that should have read the fine print, first and foremost. And secondly,
should have
down never
payment.
Been allowed to have that mortgage to begin with.
I think the government caused it.
I don't disagree with you. Now, my point is this. It's not class
warfare. I don't disagree with
it's
you.
It's just bad economic
but
policy.
But there's also nothing wrong with people making money. There's nothing
that's
wrong with that.
The problem
right now, and we have this question, is people don't have jobs. So that's where we really need to focus on how to
do it.
Well,
should get off $2 trillion in cash and stop laying off 30,000.
Unless the government provides some incentives to do that.
So what? Can we let Rick Perry and they start hiring? Last word for you quickly.
Well, first of all, I think this is a great conversation. But rather than go to the ends of creating class warfare, why don't we get at the underlying issues of the problem?
Quickly what?
Education, training. Why
is capital, I'll give you education and training if you give me capital requirements in the banking
and
system.
And get money out of system.
But I have the education and training
are
already
created. You won't give me capital requirements?
Wait, listen, the
banking system is already so overregulated today.
One regulation. I will get rid of every regulation you've ever had and say that if you don't retain risk, you are not a capitalist. I will leave it on that note and thank Denny, thank my panel, and thank you for sticking around.
That was a good discussion. That wasn't exactly the one I was looking for, but it was pretty good. Anyway, the whole key to this is that these guys are infiltrating the group, and good, bad, or indifferent, I think.
Has to be said.
Yeah, exactly. Excuse me a second. I wanted to bring your attention to this. I think we'll do the. I wanted to do some. Health issues tonight,
mm-hmm.
And I thought,
what do we have here?
I've got this one here. This quick thing. It's a quick report by Russian TV.
U.S. pharmacy, pharmaceutical companies, industry creates disease to cure them.
Right, to cure diseases
mm-hmm.
that they create, and I think you'll get a kick out of this. But let me. Let me play it.
Now, from canine depression to female sexual dysfunction, U.S. pharmaceutical companies get creative when it comes to disorders and drugs to treat them. Well, the industry has been accused of illegally pushing medicine onto the market, often endangering the lives of patients. And as RT's Lauren Lister found out, the American drug trade is a multi-billion-dollar business and is only getting bigger.
Things that we prescribe medication for in dogs are aggression and anxiety disorders. Yeah, Prozac works great on dogs.
You heard it right. Doggy Prozac, a bee-flavored version of the well-known human antidepressant, government-approved and being prescribed by veterinarians for canines in crisis.
There is a significant population of dogs that really have suffering from separation anxiety.
The drug company, one of the largest, is banking on that. They believe up to 17% of U.S. dogs are suffering from this mental affliction. It's an idea some would scoff at.
I definitely understand being skeptical.
So is this really a quest to help feisty Fidos, or is it a sign of this?
Companies desperate to keep up their profit margin and doing things to keep the margin up, even though the number of new drugs that are important in the pipeline has diminished.
It turns out those companies don't need doggy drugs in order for critics to make that case. Medical researchers crunched the numbers and found the pharmaceutical industry now tops the defense industry as the number one defrauder of the U.S. government.
That was a finding that I didn't expect. No one had really ever looked at it before, and it shows you how out of control, really, the pharmaceutical industry is.
In some cases, criminally out of control, perhaps helping this industry go from selling $40 billion to $234 billion a year in prescription drugs. Over the last two decades, companies have been cheating and endangering patients. Their biggest violations are overcharging the government by billions and illegally marketing their drugs for uses they aren't proven safe or effective for.
We're outside
the world headquarters of one of the largest offenders. One of the biggest criminal penalties ever levied against any American corporation involved this drug giant, Pfizer. Their illegal practices included essentially hiring physicians to spread buzz about a drug, telling their colleagues to prescribe it for a condition it wasn't approved for.
Drug pushers is a not unfair way of describing them.
I've had difficulty achieving orgasm.
And when it comes to the drug companies, disease pushers may not be an unfair way of describing them either. That's what one filmmaker found, tracing a newly minted disorder.
Female sexual dysfunction itself was definitely something that the pharmaceutical industry really pushed for and had a hand in creating.
That's the conclusion Kanner came to after following the process of a drug company developing female Viagra. She says only a small number of women need it, but the company has other plans.
Their marketing and the amount of money that they were pouring into it really says that they're trying to sell this to the whole population.
Restless leg syndrome.
And with commercials for prescription drugs airing on TV in the U.S., companies are in a position to do just that.
You feel better.
With billions being made and not much to lose, critics say even in the case of crime, for this industry, nothing is likely to change.
Unless people go to jail, unless the fines are much larger than they have been, the companies will find that it's cheaper to cheat.
Stopping short of nothing to find some syndrome, someone, or something new to Medicaid. Lauren Lister, RT, New York.
There you go, folks. So anyway, there's one other thing I wanted to mention here tonight. This is a petition to President Obama. It's actually on whitehouse.gov. And the interesting thing about it is, let me go to it here. It's a petition that says to legalize and regulate marijuana in a manner similar to alcohol. And it says, we the people want to know when we can have our perfectly legitimate discussion on marijuana legalization. Marijuana prohibition has resulted in the arrest of over 20 million Americans since 1965.
Wow.
Yeah. Countless lives ruined and hundreds of billions of dollars squandered. And yet this policy has still failed to achieve its stated goals of lowering use rates, limiting the drug's access, and creating safer communities. Isn't it time to legalize and regulate marijuana in a manner similar to alcohol? If not, please explain why you feel that the continued criminalization of cannabis will achieve the results in the future that has never achieved in the past. This is the petition that's being asked. Now, the signatures needed by October 22nd, 2011, were 5,000 signatures. Okay?
Yeah. Oh, that's
they only needed 5,000. They, to date, have 59,571. Mm. And do you know, earlier this afternoon when I posted this, it was actually 291. So this thing's traveling the internet.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You put something up on the internet, and then all of a sudden, everybody.
I posted. I'm sure others have. So it's like, but it's up to 59,578. So there is no reason. Okay, actually, you have to October 22nd, and I can say, well, maybe they'll stop this in October 22nd. All right. But he has to follow through on it, you know, and it's got to go there. And this is the whitehouse.gov petition. So this goes directly to Obama, all right? So that's what it's designed for, all right? It's a government thing. And 59,578 people have signed this, okay?
That's pretty
given
good.
Their names to the president and said, why can't we have this, you know? And we want to know, we want some answers. And I thought that was important to bring up. And you can go to, if you want to sign it yourself, you can go to, it ends on October 22nd, but you can go to petitions, White House, what was it, whitehouse.gov, okay, and sign in there. You got to sign in an account, but... It's and you can go in there. You can see all the different petitions on everything.
Wow.
All the issues that people are
trying to bring.
But that one there, I mean, you only needed 5,000 signatures. You got 59,000, you know, right? In less than a month.
Whoa.
So, I mean, it tells you that a whole lot of people want this thing questioned. All right?
What else do you have?
Well, I thought there was this is another very interesting thing. Then I'll bring up some health issues. But
well, you only have 20 minutes.
Yeah, Pete's going to come on, and then we get some more time after that. So, but this is kind of interesting. I don't know if I've read this before, but I thought it'd be interesting to read it again. The risk of terrorism. You are 17,600 times more likely to die from heart attack than from a terrorist attack.
You were 12,571 times more likely to die from cancer than from a terrorist attack.
You are 11,000 times more likely to die in an airplane accident than from a terrorist plot involving an airplane.
You are 1,048 times more likely to die from a car accident than from a terrorist attack.
And you are 404 times more likely to die in a fall than from a terrorist attack.
You are 87 times more likely to drown than die in a terrorist attack.
And you are 12 times more likely to die from accidental suffocation in bed than from a terrorist attack.
You are 9 times more likely to choke to death on your own vomit than die in a terrorist attack.
You are 8 times more likely to be killed by a police officer than by a terrorist.
You are 8 times more likely to die from electrocution than from a terrorist attack.
And you are 6 times more likely to die from hot weather than from a terrorist attack. Now that kind of tells you what the risk of terrorism is. And,
not too bad.
And to think of all the money that's poured into that, you know, is totally
bogus.
Totally bogus. It's totally absurd, you know. Unbelievable. But anyway, that's what we have. And unfortunately, I bumped out of this thing. But we got some other good stuff for you tonight. Hang on one second.
Not always easy with these computers, and not always cooperate.
They don't cooperate all the time. There's Facebook here. The guy's got a
says, quit comparing me to Obama.
As Hitler. And a friend of mine just posted that. Kind of funny. But I know people don't get into it. Maybe some do. But I get the biggest kick out of Facebook because of the friends that I have that keep sending me interesting stuff all the time. And let's see. This one is interesting tonight. Pat Robertson says that Obama is inciting people to revolt. And that kind of cracked me up. And
this is from Raw Story?
Yeah. Here
you go. Add another entry. Oh, here it is. Add another entry to the long list of controversial statements made by television preacher Pat Robertson. On Monday morning's broadcast of the 700 Club, Robertson named President Barack Obama for being the mastermind behind Occupy Wall Street. While the match to the kindling is being provided by our noble president, the televangelist said, he's inciting people to revolt. Robertson failed to cite any specific evidence linking Obama to being behind the demonstration. Last week, Robertson called the protesters clowns and nuts. With those statements, it is unlikely that Robertson will be speaking at any of the Occupy sites. Watch the video from the 700 Club.
Yeah,
you can watch that if you want.
Let's see what he says. Only 37 seconds. I think we can tolerate
Yeah.
The 37 seconds.
They're going to this Occupy Wall Street protest going on in this country, Pat. You have to wonder, is it going to turn violent? I don't expect it to because of the winter months ahead. But, you know, as you look ahead to next year, an election year, and the summer, your thoughts go back to 1968, which was a cauldron in this country.
Well, the match to the kindling is being provided by Arnold Noble, president, and he is exciting people to revolt. Very strange.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one, a couple of just quick ones from Ross Story that I thought I'd bring up. 40 Seattle cops arrest one woman for sitting down opening an umbrella. Okay. New York Police Department arrest Occupy protester, non-protester at Citibank branch. The person wasn't even a protester, and they arrested him.
In the way, probably.
Yep. And Chris Hedges states that corporations have carried out a coup d'etat in this country. And so, anyway, I just thought I'd mention those. And we'll go back. And there's something else I wanted to mention here, too. My article was on the paying for major article today was I'm going to find it. Here it is.
Now Eve did a lot of stuff on someone at school did some stuff on reading and seeing what's going on politically.
Okay. But
I just thought about that.
She's kind of brain dead. I'm surprised that she's doing it. Anyway, the price of power, congressional leadership positions for sale.
Oh, this is horrible.
To the highest bidder.
I couldn't believe this.
Yeah.
We have to go to the previous page. You have to go to, we're not on the
right.
correct page. You
right.
have to go
you
all the way back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To go back two
okay.
pages. That's not going to take you back.
No, it's not. Hang on a second. Here is a single page. Let's see if we can go. Yes.
Okay. The Democratic Congressional, let's see. Yes. The following appears in the current issue of the Washington Spectator.
Yes. Yeah, uniquely among legislatures in the developed world, our congressional parties now post prices for the key slots on committees. You want it, you buy it.
And it's called pay for play or play to pay.
Play to pay.
Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee asked rank and file members to contribute $125,000 in dues to raise an additional $75,000 for the party. Subcommittee chairpersons must contribute $150,000 in dues and raise an additional $100,000. Members who sit on the most powerful committees must contribute $200,000 and raise an additional $250,000. Subcommittee chairs on power committees and committee chairs of non-power committees contribute $250,000 and raise $250,000. The five chairs of the power committees must contribute $500,000 and raise an additional $1 million. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, Majority Whip James Clyburn, and Democratic Caucus Chairperson Rahm Emanuel must contribute $800,000 and raise $2.5 million. The four Democrats who serve as part of the extended leadership must contribute $450,000. This must be an old article.
This was under the rules for the 2008 election cycle.
Yeah, $450,000. And raise $500,000. And the nine chief deputy whips must contribute $300,000 and raise $500,000. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi must contribute a staggering $800,000 and raise an additional $25
million. Holy cow. That's amazing. This year is 1909. The U.S. income distribution is about as lopsided as it is today. J.P. Morgan is fine-tuning a tariff bill by telegraph from his yacht. And Morgan and his fellow robber barons have for years reliably tied Congress up in knots whenever anyone proposed regulating trusts, railroad rates, financial speculation, or labor disputes. A notoriously corrupt ring of U.S. senators, the so-called Millionaires Club, is on hand to bury in committee any measures that the corporate titans frown upon. Now, fast forward to 2011. Being a millionaire in Congress is nothing special, but about half of the ball members are one, and the legislative process works less operatically. But the result is pretty much the same. Legislative gridlock, punctuated by occasional blatant self-interest, special interest legislation. Banks are rescued. The unemployed are left to their own devices. The household market is left in free fall, and the bailout banks almost still left to call the tune on foreclosures. As national...
Yeah, I got to get a little closer. It's a little hard to read this from up here. As national income stagnates, finances submerge, financial reforms and derivative regulation under waves of campaign contributions. Meanwhile, a vast array of interested firms and investors dispatch armies of lobbyists to stymie congressional action on climate change, block the government from bargaining down prices of drugs paid for by federal health programs, and keep tax increases forever off the national agenda. We watch the news to see if congressional stalemates over deficits will lead to a government default that would throw world financial markets into turmoil or force draconian across-the-board budget cuts at Thanksgiving time. But while we hold our breath, popular discussions about Congress have taken a curious turn. Pundits talk nostalgically about the good old days when representatives from the two parties regularly played golf together and compromised their differences in the name of the larger national interest. Today, such outcomes are said to be impossible. But why exactly? The rivers of political money that now swirl 24/7 around Capitol Hill surely play a role in producing the great D.C. stalemate machine. But tired recitations of astronomical campaign finance spending totals don't tell the full story. Neither does the observations that since 1990s, the Republican leaders both in Congress and out have raised enormous amounts of money from investor blocs that plainly hope to roll back the New Deal as a whole. We need to look at the bigger picture. The tidal wave of chaos has structurally transformed Congress. It swept away the old seniority system that used to govern leadership selection and committee assignments in Congress. In its place, the parties copied practices of the big box realtors like Walmart, Best Buy, or Target.
Retailers
like Walmart, Best Buy, or Target. Uniquely among legislatures in the developed world, our congressional parties now post prices for key slots on committees. You want it, you buy it, runs the challenge. They even sell on the installment plan. You want to chair an important committee? That'll be $200,000 down and the same amount later through fundraising. Unlike most retailers, though, congressional leaders selling committee positions never offer discounts. Prices only drift up over time. The practice is perhaps the one case when bipartisanship flourishes in Congress today. The Democrats' 2008 price schedules quoted in Corinda's Money in the House are just variations on themes introduced by the Republicans in the 1990s when Newt Gingrich brought in the earliest versions of pay-to-play and Tom DeLay consulted computer printouts of members' contributions at meetings to decide on committee chairs. Everybody in D.C. isn't on the game. Only the public is still in the dark.
A new normal. Posting prices in this fashion does more than energize members of Congress to hunt up new sources of cash in hope of advancing their careers and winning every election. The practice makes cash flow the basic detriment of the very structure of lawmaking. Instead of buffering at least some outside forces, congressional committees and party leadership are supposed to reflect the shape of political money. And in our new gilded age, it is obvious where most of that comes from. The whole adds up to something far more sinister than the parts, but interest groups, think finance or oil or utilities or healthcare, can control the memberships of the committees that write the legislation that regulate them. And outside investors and interest groups also become decisive in resolving leadership struggles within the party of Congress. You want your man or woman in the leadership? to send money, and lots of it.
You get the drift, folks. It's pay to play. You buy your way in, and then when you get in, you buy your way to the top. That's all.
Yeah, and all that money talk. It's like on the edges, of course, factors besides money still play some role, especially in ordinary committee assignments. But the new normal looks like this. In 2009, when the Democrats controlled the House, their leadership slotted many junior representatives on the Financial Services Committee so they could haul in cash with both hands to enhance their prospects for re-election. And all the money talked today, despite the passage of the Dodd-Frank financial reforms, U.S. regulators can't tell which American financial houses are exposed to what risk if default by Greece knocks over one or another big European bank. But the real rub is the way the system centralizes power in the hands of top congressional leaders. In a new pay-to-play system, individual representatives dole out contributions to their colleagues to gain support for their individual bids for key positions within each chamber. But the system also requires them to make large contributions to the House and Senate national campaign committees. These are normally controlled by congressional leaders in each chamber, along with perhaps the White House when the president comes from the same party. So, basically, money talks. And the article goes on a little ways longer, but we got a few more. We'll get something else to cover. But I thought that might be interesting to note.
Yep.
Also, Goldman Sachs. Report,
this is interesting.
$393 million loss.
That surprised me.
Yeah, me too.
That kind of caught me off guard. I was very surprised at that.
Yeah. And, well, it's an interesting thing because there are a lot of things going wrong with it. Hang on a second. I just thought it was kind of bizarre for them to lose money. But that tells you what's happening, because investors don't trust them.
Yeah, who could put your money in that place?
When you know that they're a crooked group and they're betting against you, against your investment, you know. Goldman report, now this morning, now this is interesting how that changed. This morning, they reported a $393 million loss.
Huh.
Except this evening, they report a $428 million loss. All right, so
Goldman Sachs has reported a third quarter net loss of $428 million, only the second time since going public in 1999. Wall Street's most admired and reviled investment bank has not made a profit. The summer of turmoil that started in Europe and spread to the global markets produced $2.9 billion in paper losses on the bank's investments, dragging it loss and raising questions over whether Goldman's famed earning power is damaged temporarily or more fundamentally. Lloyd Blankfein, chief executive, acknowledged he was disappointed with results that he attributed to lower confidence among corporate clients and investors and declining asset prices around the world. Protesters from Occupy Wall Street campaign gathered close to Goldman's Manhattan headquarters have continued to demonstrate against the financial sector's might, even as banks have faltered. Morgan Stanley may report an over-operating loss today. Goldman's loss of 84 cents per share compared with earnings of $2.98 per share in the third quarter last year. Revenues plunged from $8.9 billion to $3.6 billion. With the performance from Goldman's investing and lending business, which includes its principal investment arm and a stake in Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, reporting sharply worse figures. As it cuts costs to cope with a tough environment, Goldman said it had, as planned, shed 1,300 jobs in the quarter, or 500 excluding the sale of one business and the acquisition of another. Howard Chen, analyst at Credit Suisse, said investors were asking whether the bank was suffering the effects of a host of new regulations and whether more subdued earnings were here to stay. I think a lot of people are reading into today's weakened earnings as driven by secular headwinds, he said. The bank's business model is under threat from a slew of regulations, from the Volcker Rule that has that bans proprietary trading to new restrictions on derivatives trading. But Mr. Chen argued that Goldman's third quarter results reflected other factors, such as the crises in Europe. I believe this is largely cynical. I think the cyclical. I think the secular headwinds are potentially to come. Bonuses are set to shrink for Goldman's bankers, but the percentage payout could increase over the year. At the moment, it is setting aside 44% of revenues compared with 39% last year. So even though they do lousy, they still get rewarded?
Yeah. Shares in Goldman rose 5.5% to 102.25 after falling from a high this year of $175 per share. So I personally think I think this whole thing is showing they're in trouble. And if I was an investor in them, I would never. I would be pulling out all my funds.
We have our caller on.
Oh, you do. Okay.
Yeah, our guest.
All right.
So
let's bring on his music. Yeah.
That's what I was kind of looking for. Into the ring with Woody.
Thank you, Lila. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, my Stone Cold Locks, the NFL, and of course, baseball. Let's get right down to it. Thus far as the season goes, I am 12-5-1. Pretty damn good. That's not bad. Those are good odds. I'd take those anytime. So, my picks for this week are as follows. I'm going to take the Chicago Bears. They're playing in London over in jolly old England. And they're playing Tampa Bay. The Bears are getting 1 point. I'll take that point. The Bears put in some new pass protection schemes. And you can see some of those on display Sunday night when they smashed Minnesota. The next game I'm going to pick, I like Pittsburgh, and the spread on that is -4. They're playing at Arizona. Arizona has been playing not all that well. I don't care that they're home. It's the kind of game Pittsburgh needs to win, so I'm going to just stick with Pittsburgh. The next game that I like is a very easy pick. It's Green Bay at Minnesota. The spread is 9.5. You probably want to jump on it before it turns to 10 or even 12. Real easy game to pick there. Minnesota stinks. Green Bay is thus far undefeated, and I don't see Minnesota stepping in Green Bay's way. Although Minnesota is probably going to get rid of Donovan McNabb as a starting quarterback, and they're probably going to give that young kid a new chance. Interesting thing, I watched a few games over the weekend, a couple interesting things. A lot of people had Buffalo over the New York Giants, but the Giants pulled out a victory. You know, this is like the typical kind of Giants. As I had said the week before, you know, even though I picked the Giants, it was the kind of game that the Giants wouldn't cover or wouldn't win. And sure enough, they didn't cover or didn't win. And then here we are the following week where everyone is in love with Buffalo. And there you go, the Giants go and win the game. So when you're betting, it's always good to avoid the Giants. It's just you're just much better off avoiding the Giants. They're so hard to decipher sometimes. It's unbelievable. The Dallas Cowboys, I watched that game against the Patriots. The Cowboys are much improved. They certainly should have won the game over the Patriots, but, you know, Tom Brady worked his magic, and sometimes that's the way it goes. But the Cowboys are much improved. As far as the Eagles go, Took them four interceptions to beat Washington. I really don't think Philadelphia is going anywhere this year. They have a lot of problems, and they're, you know, the supposed dream team. So I found that somewhat amusing. As I mentioned earlier, Chicago trounced Minnesota. That was the Sunday night game. And, you know, even though Minnesota isn't that good, they do have one of the best pass rushes in the league. And Chicago has installed some new pass blocking schemes, and Cutler had some time, and they put the hammer on Minnesota. So good for Chicago to fix a problem, you know, because that's been a big problem. Cutler's been getting knocked around, and, you know, you want your quarterback upright, not laying down. The final game that I watched was the Jets, Jets. As I predicted, they did squish the fish. However, the game itself was really very ugly and unwatchable. The Jets offense went three and out many times in a row. Sure, the defense played all right. Revis returned an interception for a pick six. However, had it been a better quarterback, there was a lot of receivers that were running wide open that were just plain old missed by the Dolphins quarterback. So, you know, the Jets have San Diego Chargers this weekend, and, you know, it is at home, and, you know, West Coast teams have a tough time when they come out here. I just think, you know, the way the Jets looked, I mean, they really, that was a team that absolutely positively needed a win. Miami is a team that pretty much gave up, and if things had gone the way they should have, the game probably would have been 17-13, and wow, the Jets, you know, just for a team that really needed a win, just really didn't play that great. Although they won, that's, you know, sometimes people are like, well, they won, that's the bottom line, but not really, that's not always the bottom line. Okay, moving on. Now, as I spoke about prior, the Boston Red Sox had gotten rid of their longtime manager, Terry Francona. Now, the Red Sox did something. Well, certain people in the organization have – things are starting to leak out now. And they played a bit of dirty pool with their manager, in my opinion. Although I never liked Francona, you know, obviously he managed a team that I can't stand, you know, the Boston Red Sox. I did think the guy was a good manager. However, I thought it was kind of dirty pool for members of the organization, the Red Sox, to say that his taking of pain pills – affected his managerial skills. This guy was taking pain pills throughout the season when the Red Sox were in first place. So I'm not exactly sure how him taking pain pills at the end of the season had anything to do with the garbage play in the field that was, you know, given up by a lot of his pitchers and guys weren't performing and stuff. So I just thought it was really kind of dirty pool and just really uncalled for. Now, they have a number of problems that are now seeming to come out in the paper. Apparently, their pitchers, Beckett, Lackey, and Lester, you know, have been accused of drinking in the clubhouse on nights that they don't have to pitch. The captain of the team, Veritek, is supposedly in that stuff. And they've just been very unpleasant to all the members of the team. They kind of been hanging out in their own little clique, so on and so forth. Lester came forward and said, yeah, well, we have a few ninth-inning beers, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. It doesn't happen all that often. And then unnamed Boston Red Sox employees said it happens every day. And it was just a lot of very unpleasant things are being written, you know, in the Boston papers about players, you know, doing stuff that you don't think or you would certainly not want your players to do. Me as a Yankee fan, I would be disgusted if my guys were sitting there getting their drink on during a game. And you got to think that other teammates that are out there sweating out there, maybe in a hot 100-degree day out there sweating, and these guys are sitting on the bench drinking. I don't know. I would personally find that kind of insulting. So a lot of people in the media and a lot of Red Sox fans, whom I heard on the Red Sox station, are complaining about, you know, Beckett and Lackey, and they don't want him back on the team. Beckett still has a great degree of skill, and he would be an easy trade, and maybe he doesn't want to come back. Lackey is just garbage, and he has a rotten attitude, and I would I would be extremely shocked if he comes back. Beckett, I think there's probably a 70% chance he doesn't come back as well. Lester's awfully young, and maybe they figure if they can cut out the cancer. Beckett was the leader of this whole ordeal. That's been well publicized. And, you know, people in Boston are rather unforgiving, you know, after this 9-game collapse. And somebody's got to bear the brunt of it. And, you know, maybe as far as management was concerned, Francona was going to bear the brunt of that. And as far as Francona was concerned, he just wasn't coming back. Francona, I don't think was coming back either way. He resigned, and if he didn't resign, I don't think management was going to bring him back. But he resigned on his own terms. Good for him. I certainly wouldn't want to put up with that BS in my clubhouse either. You know, he just kind of lost control, and, you know, those are the breaks. So I think it's going to be real interesting come spring training to see, you know, who's still on the team. I would be remiss if I did not speak quickly about the World Series. I just wanted to go into the Red Sox thing because it's been, you know, and it's in a lot of the news. It seems like it's gotten a lot more print than the World Series itself. The World Series itself involves the Texas Rangers versus the St. Louis Cardinals. In my opinion, the Rangers have a better team. However, the Cardinals have a better manager of the team. You know, they got a few great players on the Cardinals, Albert Pujols, Lance Berkman, who was a former Yankee, who I wanted us to re-sign, but we didn't. I'm taking the Rangers in this one. Ron Washington is, you know, a decent manager. As I said, La Russa, the Cardinals, is a better manager, but I think the guys in the field are going to decide this one. So I'm going to take the Rangers in five. I think they're a much better team than the Cardinals. I think the Cardinals are garbage. They caught a little bit of lightning in a bottle in the National League, and that's going to come to an end. Speaking of coming to an end, that's the end of my segment. That's it for this week. Shout out to all my woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, and my partner, Money Mike, and Big Steve. That's it for this week. Until next week, stay warm because it's kind of getting brisk out there.
For his segment.
Yeah.
And guess what, folks? There's still more news.
Yeah, we got another 15 minutes, so I thought I'd lighten things up with just a little bit with, you know,
Fox News. I can't believe this. I just couldn't believe it when Leo found it and told me about it. It
says, President Obama is dead. This is from Fox News.
Listen to this.
Yeah. A Fox News reporter says President Obama is dead while discussing Osama bin Laden's death.
So he didn't know the difference?
This is the original video that was recorded.
Obama, Osama, to him it was all the same.
Okay. Now listen to this. This is true. This really did happen.
Let us remember that we can do these things not just because of wealth or power,
Osama,
but because of who we are.
Killed last night.
One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. May God bless you. And may God bless the United States of America.
President Obama speaking from the East Room of the White House, telling the nation and the world President Obama is in fact dead. It was a U.S.-led strategic, Osama bin Laden is dead, a strategic operation. They caught him in a mansion outside.
You guys are morons.
Up next, here's another one.
This is very funny. News anchor Phil compilation. That's this one here. Is
yeah.
I'll just play this because this is a little longer, but it's funny.
Listen to this.
Drama in Washington as the August 2nd budget deadline near.
This weekend, President Obama and top lawmakers are working to come up with a budget agreement so they can raise the amount of money that our country can borrow.
More in his favor tonight. Fox News correspondent Laura Engel explains.
One more bottle.
only functions in the news this morning. The next time you pass gas, make sure no police are around. A man in West Virginia faces assault charges after police say he passed gas and vandalized the officer. After the man was already arrested for DUI, according to police reports, I can't even get through this.
He passed the gas so loud and the officer said it was, quote, very odorous and created contact of an insulting or provoking nature.
Mr. Anchorman.
See, that wasn't even right. That was, to put that story in there was wrong. That was wrong, man.
I didn't see it when I was looking through the script. Who put that in there?
Very odorous.
There you go.
All right.
Now, as you know, I did share a gag with Dalai Lama because he was in such fine form. I suppose that I would tell this gag. Now, it did prove to be not my most successful ever. Check it out. The Dalai Lama walks into a pizza shop.
Pizza shop.
And says, can you make me one with everything?
What's that? That's what it is. Oh, yes.
You know what I mean? Can you make me one with everything?
He's saying this with everything. Dalai Lama, the actual Dalai Lama.
Oh, impossible. Oh, I knew that wouldn't work.
He laughed more at the fact that it didn't work.
He didn't know what pizza was. So we're going to fall down there, isn't it?
You know that a joke's in trouble if you've got a translator off to the side every couple of words.
Anyway, I felt better having spoken to him, and I think everyone who talks to him does.
With everything, it's the pizza, and he's the...
You should have said the lot. One with the lot.
One with the lot.
No.
Maybe with the hamburger.
Good evening, I'm Ken Bastida. Dana is off tonight. He was murdered and then set on fire while celebrating his birthday.
Through the website with all the details on what they plan to do. And the city of San Antonio is supposed to... Blah, blah, blah. Sorry.
Well, let's just move on. Is Al-Shabaab the new Al-Qaeda? Well, look at that coming up.
And I got the free version on my phone.
Wait, are they licking their phones?
Yeah, dude, check it out. Okay, so you open it. So you open it up.
You want me to lick the...
No, read the directions.
Oh, read the directions. Press smell button and let the glass fill.
Awesome. Check it out.
Hold phone.
Smell it.
Nope.
You've been licking part where you can taste it.
I am not licking an iPad.
Lick it. Come on.
I'm not talking to you.
You're actually looking at an iPad.
No, that's not very nice. I'm not going back. You're on your own for the rest of the show. You played April Fool's joke on me.
April Fool's Day.
She actually missed it.
That's not funny.
Thank you.
being heard about how Obama was killed and what led to the American forces finding out where he was. It started when Obama took office. He directed the head of the CIA to make killing Obama their number one priority. Back in August, they got a possible lead on where Obama might be hiding. He was located, possibly, they believed at that time, in a compound deep within Pakistan.
And guys, the shot lasts between 4 and 6 months, and Susan, who you met in our story, says that is one appointment she is not going to miss because she says it worked for her.
So she's enjoying penis a little bit more, is she?
She's enjoying her sex life a little bit more. She and her husband.
Thank you, Michael.
Yes, that's Dr. Serene for some serious business. I agree. I think the phones are going to be ringing.
Yes, they will.
More teens are having luck, funny.
This is all on Fox News, folks.
That
was really funny. We'll end with that one.
So much for that.
Can you imagine saying that on the air like that?
Oh, it was good, yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
I'm sure I've said some things that I misspoke or something, but not quite like that.
Not quite like that. It's like, you know, unbelievable.
So what was she thinking about if she missed
the I don't know.
Between luck and fuck?
It's funny, though, how many people kept saying Obama and Osama.
Yeah, well,
you
it seems like they're not clear who it is.
But she kept repeating it.
And didn't catch it.
No, she said Obama is dead. And the CIA states Obama is dead.
She didn't catch herself. At least the others kind of caught themselves a little bit.
Afterwards, I apologize, but this one kept going and going. It's really funny. We got another 20 minutes. And I wanted to,
Ten minutes.
And I wanted to bring this up because this has been in the news recently, and it's a big hoax.
Yeah, the attack on vitamins?
Yeah, you know.
Vitamins.
And it's really been a big, big hoax by the media and by the pharmaceutical companies. And I'm going to get to that. And this is from naturalnews.com. And for if anybody's seen this on TV recently, in the news the last week or so, they've been coming out and saying that there are reports that multivitamins and so on and supplements are dangerous.
Time, USA Today, MSNBC, NPR, CTV, and the LA Times, and numerous other mainstream media outlets have all been running a juvenile hoax over the last week. Through various misleading headlines, they're all claiming that vitamins might kill you. And here are some of the headlines. Study links vitamins to higher death rates in women. That's CTV. Study vitamins may increase death risk in older women. USA Today. We've been wasting a ton of money on vitamins and dietary supplements. Time. Some common vitamin supplements could increase death risk, MSNBC. Dietary supplements risky for older women, study finds, LA Times, etc. Let's see.
The whole thing is a hoax.
Yep.
And Natural News is stepping forward to expose it.
Caught yet again, the mainstream media has been exposed, pulling off a juvenile, simplistic hoax that attempts to scare people away from good nutrition. To accomplish this hoax, they took a poorly constructed scientific study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, which was itself based on erroneous conclusions, and then blatantly misreported what the study data actually showed. The journal is owned, not surprisingly, by the American Medical Association, which has a long and sordid history of openly attacking vitamins and nutrition, even to the point of committing crimes that violate federal law. Remember, the AMA has been found guilty of conspiracy in federal courts. All this is yet another case of quack journalism on the part of the mainstream media, which is largely funded by pharmaceutical interests, of course. They never miss an opportunity to try to attack vitamins and dietary supplements, even if it means revealing they are total big pharma prostitutes who pretend to be real journalists. But don't take my word for it. Let's do something the mainstream media prostitutes never do and actually look at the study data for a change. What the study reveals, Leo.
His study is entitled Dietary Supplements and Mortality Rate in Older Women. And the study claims to have reviewed a vitamin and mineral supplement used in 38,772 older women by mailing them three surveys over 18 years, asking them to recall what vitamins and minerals they were taking.
Oh, yeah, right.
So over 3 years, over 18 years.
You're going to remember that?
Yeah,
I can hardly remember what I just took last week.
So hold the presses. This is a survey study, or what's commonly called an
observational
study, which are notoriously inaccurate to begin with. As David Brownstein told me in a groundbreaking InfoWars Nightly News interview, this study says absolutely nothing about vitamins, Dr. Brownstein said. If this study was done in reverse, or vitamins were shown to be effective, no journal would have printed this study because it was so poorly done. And the study data were altered. One of the most glaring total fabrications in this particular study is the alteration of the data, of the raw data, using statistical voodoo. If you go to Table 2 of the study, which we can't post here because it's not a public document, it shows a hazard ratio number associated with each of the nutrients covered in the study, which is vitamin D, calcium, copper, iron, and so on. There's also a number associated with multivitamins. With these numbers, one means neutral or no increase in mortality. A number below one, such as 9.2, means a reduction in mortality, and 9.2 would mean an 8% reduction in mortality. But numbers that are higher, okay, would. But they're all so minute, okay. Vitamins B complex was associated with a 7% reduction in mortality, okay.
Mm.
Vitamin C was associated with a 4% reduction. Vitamin D, an 8% reduction. Magnesium, a 3% reduction. Selenium, 3% reduction, and zinc was a 3% reduction in mortality. I bet you didn't read that in the mainstream media, huh? That's because they never reported these numbers. And once again, they cherry-picked numbers, whatever scary data they wanted to show you while ignoring the rest. Okay, folic acid was associated with a 9% increase in mortality, and a copper associated with 31% increase in mortality. Multivitamins, mainstream media viciously attacked with their lying whore headlines, which associated with, guess what, only a 2% increase in mortality. Okay, so they voodooed up the statistics, and the data were altered a second time. To massage the data just once, these study authors went even further and actually changed all the results a second time. This was done through yet another multivariable adjustment. Now, you got to remember, who did these tests? The pharmaceutical companies. And who judged the data? The pharmaceutical companies. Right? And they said what was done, though, yet through multivariable adjustments in which the authors adjusted for age, education level, place of residence, diabetes, high blood pressure, body mass, waist-to-hip ratio. I mean, there's all kinds of crap that they pulled on this stuff. So that the entire thing was just completely and utterly, absolutely bogus.
Yep.
So there you go, folks. So keep on taking your vitamins. It's good for you. And,
certainly don't listen to the mainstream media in that regard.
No,
do a little research
no.
of your own and,
we,
you know, determine what you want to do.
We got a little, about a minute left here. And I was going to play us out with a song by Tom Waits tonight.
Oh, that'd be
brand
good.
New album. And I'm not sure if we can do this, but I figured we should. Because,
Tom Waits is a born storyteller, loves a good yarn.
Yeah, it's a great name. Please go, if you like Tom Waits, you might want to go to this pitchfork.com, which is, has a great interview with him. And they even have actually a song. And I think I'm going to play the next 30 seconds out with this song.
Yeah, very,
so
very nice.
So,
wow. That's coming out, huh?
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that.
There was another one called Bad Like Bad As Me, which is the actual name
play
of
that
the,
on another show.
I think that's the name of his album.
Cal's album, boy. He's got a lot of talent, that guy.
Yeah, Bad As Me. So take a look for it on your... And your, you can check out, go to TomWaits.com or go to TomWaits.com and check out his website. It's very good.
Well, good night, folks. Thanks for being with us tonight, and we look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
Yes, we do. And I want to thank everybody for joining us, and we hope you had a good night. And we'll see you tomorrow night. Okay. We'll see you tomorrow night.